This week, we dive into the world of J.D. Buck and Dr. R. Swyburn Clymer, who wrote extensively on mysticism within Freemasonry. Then, we learn about the seldom-known incident within Freemasonry that started off the first anti-Masonic sentiment in America. A request for initiation, absurd oaths, drugs, including laxatives, and starting a man on fire. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. You're going to want to hear this story. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 610. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. Without you, we cannot make this program. And I am so thankful that we have all of your support. Since 2011, we've been producing this show, and it's no small endeavor. So if you would like to know how you can be a part of the WCY podcast, please visit WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options. This week, we've got a couple of great articles. One that I ran just recently in the Lyceum, which will be going out, I believe, Tuesday, September 26th for the Grand Lodge of Illinois. It'll be the second-to-last issue of this particular volume. We've got October, and then we'll start Volume 2 in December. So, right away, let's get into the first piece this week, as I mentioned, and it's called Understanding the Mysticism in Freemasonry. And it was produced as a guest contributor article by Brother Joseph Covell. Now, Brother Joseph Covell is pretty new to Masonry. He was raised in March of 2022 at Quakertown Lodge number 512 in Quakertown, Pennsylvania. He is a student of esoteric philosophy since 2016, and he loves to discuss it with like-minded brethren. He's involved in the Valley of Allentown, ancient accepted Scottish Rite, where he helps administer the Valley's social media accounts. He's also a member of several other organizations, but nonetheless, he loves Masonic education. And for that, Brother Joseph, we are in your debt. Let's get into this piece. Understanding the Mysticism in Freemasonry. Many great historians of Masonry and those concentrated on the mystery schools in general have hypothesized that the G in Masonry represents Gnosis, or simply the soul. Naysayers from the profane and non-profane worlds may say Gnosis means knowledge. The meaning behind the G is not meant to serve as a debate, only to set the wheels in motion for the understanding of the mysticism in Freemasonry. The source material to serve as the foundation for the points presented come from R. Swyburn Clymer, M.D.'s The Mysticism of Masonry and J.D. Buck, M.D.'s Mystic Masonry, with the latter serving as a huge influence for the former. Both men were heavily involved in Freemasonry in their respective eras, achieving prestigious accolades, recognition, and held offices within various fields of study. The two works will be cited in a way to serve as a high-level esoteric and exoteric view, overview of various symbolism, initiation, and degree work, and will encompass the overall philosophy of Freemasonry. Quote, "All Masonry of the past dealt largely with the ethics and symbolism of the ancient mysteries. If the Masons of the present age will but seek for the spirit of the symbolism upon which the degrees are based, the grandest achievements in knowledge and reconstruction will be possible, and the mysteries concealed in the greater mysteries of antiquity will be recovered to them." End quote. The Mysticism of Masonry, page 36. In ancient days, what was the relationship of Masonry, or the equivalent predecessor of its time, to other schools of both the lower and greater mysteries? Masonry might arguably be considered as the outer guard to the inner temple. Quote, "Among all the ancient, there was both a public and a secret worship. The secret worship did not originate in Egypt, but in Atlantis, and from thence was carried into Egypt. This secret worship always was known as the mysteries, and all of these mysteries were the same in substance or spirit. And the religious philosophy, their legends and fundamentals were identical with only a variation of characters. These mysteries could be obtained in no other manner than by initiation, and the members of these priesthoods were not known by outward signs and tokens, but by the color of their spiritual fire, with which they were enveloped, and which easily was recognized by all true initiates. The secrecy of this tradition, the secrecy of the initiation, was not because the priests did not want the people to know the inner mysteries, but due to the fact that they would not receive them in the spirit in which they would be given. The mass could not comprehend the application of material, and even gross substances toward the divine ends, and would degrade the most sacred functions of God's divine creation to gross purposes. The masses never were ready to receive the mysteries, nor are they today, much as the initiates wish to confer them upon all of God's children. End quote. The Mysticism of Masonry, page 131. When the term initiation is nonchalantly tossed about, the profane might become entrenched with the act of pledging a college fraternity or sorority during Rush Week. As time has gone by and Freemasonry's numbers have continued to dwindle from the great peak in the 1960s, many Grand Lodges operating in the United States and elsewhere have had to compromise long-standing traditions and adapt new recruiting methods such as the one-day class. The one-day class is a trend for an incoming candidate to receive all 3 degrees of Blue Lodge Masonry within the same day. The format has also been adopted by many other appendant bodies. There has existed the Man-to-Mason to Noble program to bring men into the Shriners organization. Although this may be convenient to not only receive all 3 degrees within the same day, and helpful to those brothers conferring the degrees, especially those coming from lodges that struggle to have enough qualified brothers to execute properly, it has been contested whether this method has been a success regarding retention. Whether or not this is the right way to confer degrees is inconsequential for purposes here, but no sincere ritual purist brother can make the argument that this does not hinder the intent of the rituals, for the degree in general terms is an invocation meant to be experienced in its original format. Dr. J.D. Buck had this to say regarding initiation, quote, "All real initiation is an internal, not an external process. The outer ceremony is dead and useless, only so far as it symbolizes and illustrates and thereby makes clear the inward change. The ceremony instructs, but it cannot transform." End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 86. To expand on the concept of initiation even further, Dr. R.S. Clymer has the following to add to the subject at hand, which all good Masons can of course relate to the self-Freemasonry of fortifying that inner temple. Quote, "Initiation is not what it is generally supposed to be. All Masons are familiar with the ceremonial form of initiation, but in reality, this is no more than an outward symbolization of an inner esoteric work, which should take place within each man seeking the mysteries. A man may have received the degrees of the Blue Lodge and may be an honor to that lodge and yet be wholly unfamiliar with the method of procedure which would bring into manifestation the results of the personification of the life as symbolized in these 3 degrees. It is this outcome of which not only Masons but the entire human race are now so very in need." End quote. The Mysticism of Masonry, page 6. The topic of initiation has held the focal point long enough for this piece. Let's now bring up the tall cedar in the room and address the whole secret society element that non-Masons reading this may have previously developed preconceived notions as to why certain information can only be received in ways, and much must remain secretive, although you can Google anything. Dr. Clymer offered the following support, quote, "It never was the intention of the priest initiates that the mysteries should be profoundly secret as they ultimately became. The initiates were only too willing to accept the aspirants who applied in sincerity. Moreover, they were willing to teach the people all of the profound truths they would accept. Then, as now, the people were more ready to place their own interpretations on the symbols and what they believed, erroneously, to be the inner teachings of these masters than they were to accept the actual truths from the priests. The people, then as now, were wholly unwilling to obey the law in the right spirit and condemned the initiates for having other than the letter, in other words, for reaping the fruits of their initiates' obedience." End quote. The Mysticism of Masonry, page 35. A fellow brother once said that most of our Blue Lodge rituals can be found in printed form without needing to look very hard for it. Dr. Buck may have agreed with these sentiments in the following, quote, "It is in the ancient symbols of Freemasonry that its real secrets lie concealed, and these are as densely veiled to the Mason as to any other unless he has studied the science of symbolism in general, and Masonic symbols in particular. In place of the term mystic masonry, the term symbolic masonry might have been used alone, but just here lies the whole secret, a profound mystery, and few Masons up to the present time have had the interest or the patience necessary to such investigation." End quote. Mystic Masonry, 25. To expand further on that thought, quote, "The most profound secrets of Masonry are not revealed in the Lodge at all. These secrets must be sought by the individual himself." End quote. Mystic Masonry, 26. At this point, one may be ever more fueled to question further the secretness of the craft. After all, who gets to determine what information should be withheld and who should even administer such information? Occultists believed, and practiced, that within man lay many unrealized abilities to utilize thoughts and harness certain partials out of the very air breathed. Dr. Buck summarizes, quote, "There are latent powers and almost infinite capabilities in man, the meaning of which he has hardly yet dreamed of possessing, nor will leisure and intellectual cultivation alone reveal these powers." End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 2. If he was around today to ask to explain the reason why a greater number of people in the current era aren't pursuing the quest for more knowledge, or as we Masons relate to it as light, Dr. Buck might state, quote, "We have neither the time, the energy, nor the disposition to discover the real meaning and aim of life, because all our energies are absorbed in the bare maintenance of existence." End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 5. Freemasonry is often labeled as a secret society and henceforth has drawn various degrees of critics, with those of the most extreme spawning offspring of some very imaginative and far-fetched conspiracy theories and concepts. In the age of 5G internet connectivity, where one can quickly learn all the secrets of a secret society with no sweat broken, as only the fingertips are doing the heavy lifting and through the medium of various perspectives, quote-unquote whistleblowers or infiltrators, it can be asked what true secrets are left. Dr. Buck's writings might support the ideas picked up from one's favorite podcast here, The Real Secrets of Masonry Lie Concealed in Its Symbols, and these constituting, as they do, a picture language or art speech, are made to carry a complete philosophy of the existence and relations of deity, nature, and man. Mystic Masonry, page 140. In response to those students of the esoteric variety out there searching for the hidden or occult meaning to the symbolism of Masonry, Dr. Buck has the subject covered. Quote, "Freemasonry, though not a lineal descendant of the ancient mysteries, must justly be regarded as a connecting link between the ancient wisdom and modern times. Further, the grips, signs, and passwords by which a Mason recognizes a brother pertain to the lesser mysteries. The real master knows his fellows by other signs. It has been elsewhere shown that a true adept is both clairvoyant and clairaudient." Mystic Masonry, page 123. If Dr. Clymer was here to address a gathering of historians in the field of ancient symbolism, he might have asserted the idea in this, quote, "The one thing in which historians make their great and inexplicable mistake is to accept the symbol for the spirit. Few races, even amongst the heathen, have worshipped idols. They worshipped that which these idols represented. In future centuries, the Christmas of the present will be accused with equal justice of worshipping pictures and images of Jesus and the Virgin Mary." End quote. The mysticism of Masonry. Freemasons experience all sorts of interrogation from the profane, and many can get entertaining, especially when asked about the various levels. In intrigue, one who has known a Mason having held such degree or level may offer as a platform to relate in conversation. In the days of the mystery schools, degrees were not experienced as a formality. They were the achievement to be attained after a long epoch of trials and tribulations were endured. Dr. Buck had this to say, quote, It must not be supposed that in the ancient mysteries every initiate became a master in the sense outlined in the preceding chapters. There were the lesser and the greater mysteries. To the lesser, all were eligible. To the greater, very few, and of those few, fewer still, were ever exalted to the sublime and last degree. Some remained for a lifetime in the lower degrees, unable to progress further on account of constitutional defect or mental and spiritual incapacity. End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 107. Taking a break from how Freemasonry and its symbols can intellectually and spiritually stimulate the student or candidate, the examination zooms in on the granular and broader meanings of various Masonic symbols. One of the doctors might have opened up the floor with, quote, "The triangle in the square symbolizes potential being before evolution. Man in the Garden of Eden, the square in the triangle symbolizes regeneration, the purification of the lower earthly nature so that it may ascend to the Father, return to paradise. This is symbolized by the careful position of the compass and square in relation to the Holy Bible, while the three greater lights and the three lesser lights, again, make a double triangle, one greater because above, one lesser because below, which every Mason will understand." Mystic Masonry, page 74. On an even broader scale of the symbolism, Dr. Buck explains regarding the first degree, quote, "The first lessons we are taught in Masonry is to be good men and true. And the first declaration made by the neophyte in Masonry is that he comes to the lodge to, quote, learn to subdue his passions and improve himself in Masonry. For example, to engage in the building of a fit temple for an indwelling soul." End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 112. The ante can be increased even further in respect to those transformations which are occurring in our subconscious selves. For example, that inner temple we are constructing within as the master builders that we've been taught to be. Dr. Clymer offered the following, quote, "The bringing to light in the third degree is synonymous with the finding of the light in the process of development taught and practiced in the true fraternities, but with this difference. In the Masonic initiation, it is symbolic or ritualistic. In the true initiation, it is an actual growth or development within the aspirant, and when this light is found, he is not told of it, but himself informs the master teacher. To become a master mason, one must pass through the ritualistic initiation of the third degree. This is, again, symbolic of the initiatory work of the secret fraternity when one finally has reached the third degree, which is the finding of the light of the first degree and is known as soul illumination. The unraveling of the mystery of the serpent in the next degree, and finally the attainment of mastership, which is synonymous with becoming a master mason in the exoteric organization. There is this difference. When the candidate finally becomes a master mason, he is given a substitute word for the word. But having attained the third degree in the secret fraternity, he has also found the word." End quote. The Mysticism of Masonry, page 50 to 51. As many concepts in Masonry, and for that matter, life in general, often come full circle, it cannot be stressed enough that not only is there a transformation from within while taking an oath and obligation during receiving a degree as a candidate, but there is also an inward transformation on the part of those participating in such work as an officer, guide, or other position on the floor, and including those on the sidelines. Dr. Clymer, too, felt passionately on the matter and offered, quote, "When we assume an obligation, we call certain forces into being. These forces are held in suspension or under control so long as we act in harmony with them. If we betray the spirit, then all control ceases and the created vibrations held in suspension become malicious toward the creator of them and return to rend and destroy. One who is false to an obligation has loosened a destructive force that can return only to the creator of it. God does not punish man. So-called punishment is the return to himself. Chickens come home to roost of the forces created by himself, which on betrayal return to destroy. In other words, man is not punished for his deeds, but by his deeds. It is for this reason that almost 40% of those who enter the secret fraternity ultimately bring about their own destruction, entering, as they do, for utterly selfish, though hidden, reasons. Then, because of their inimical spirit, betray the spirit and purpose of their obligation, and so bring upon themselves swift and undefiable punishment." End quote. The Mysticism of Masonry, page 52. Elaborating on the subject even further brings yet another example from the ancient mystery schools of past ages with the central theory of what might have been racing through the candidate for initiation's mind. Dr. Buck, perhaps, often struck a nerve amongst Freemasons with the following, quote, "In the ancient mysteries, life presented itself to the candidate as a problem to be solved and not as certain propositions to be memorized and easily forgotten. The solution of this problem constituted all genuine initiation, or degree, the problem expanded. As the vision of the candidate enlarged in relation to the problems and meanings of life, his powers of apprehension and assimilation also increased proportionately. This was also an evolution." End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 14. Having been heavily influenced by Dr. Buck's Mystic Masonry, Dr. Clymer's following quote could serve as the perfect complement to the prior quotation from Dr. Buck from the following excerpt. Quote, "All basic religious systems and all true secret societies teach in some way and to some degree concerning the attainment of the immortality. But most of them fail clearly to indicate that immortality must be won, that it is a personal achievement, and can be attained only through the spiritual evolution or soul development of each person." End quote. The Mysticism of Masonry, page 178. When studying mysticism and the ancient mystery schools, time and time again the conversation ends up with a discussion on the role of the pineal gland. The Egyptian eye of Horus is widely hypothesized to have been a symbolization of this little gland, and its usage and origin are to this day hotly contested and debated. Dr. Buck goes on to support the quote-unquote action of this little gland may be likened to the bridge of a violin. It renders the nerve cords more tense and thus raises the vibrations of the brain tissues. It is atrophied and therefore dormant in the average individual because the relaxed cords, using a symbol, correspond to the vibrations on the physical plane, and it is one of the well-known laws of physiology that every organ will become atrophied from disuse. End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 90. Having made a brief layover in pineal glandville, the path further leads to the invisible forces which all are capable of cultivating for higher purposes, the highest being soul consciousness. Dr. Buck would make the following point with conviction, quote, "This force is the universal life agent, as Brother Pike says, wherein are two natures and a double current of love and wrath. This ambient fluid penetrates everything. Hence, it is the first matter of the alchemists. It is concentrated in man as the magnetic living force, directed by the will. He who knows its chord of mass or the keynote of its vibrations can, by his will, waken it from space and send it in mightily, waving to do his bidding. The real world of the master, therefore, in a scientific sense, is the tone key by which the principalities and powers of the air can be made to do his bidding." End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 93. It is the intent to stimulate the reader to dive even further into the subjects presented in this piece. The following will serve as Dr. Clymer's parting gift. Quote, "Due to the unwillingness of many of these seekers to forget the self and to obey those who know, progress is necessarily slow and uncertain, and most of these attempts have given rise, more or less, to fantastic flights of the imagination, resulting in confusion rather than enlightenment, and in many cases ending in downright soul-destroying frauds of the worst and most criminal type. The gross result has been to bring the whole subject under contempt and to make the term mysticism mean something vague and uncertain, frequently foolish and questionable, to those ignorant of what the term embraces in its true meaning." End quote. The Mysticism of Masonry, page 37. Drawing it all to a whimsical finale, the focal point of the mysticism within Masonry, or simply the Mystic Masonry, will conclude with its final Dr. Buck quote, "There is a grand science known as magic, and every real master is a magician, feared by the ignorant and ridiculed by the learned. The divine science and its masters have nevertheless existed in all ages, and exist today. Masonry, in its deeper meaning and recondite mysteries, constitutes and possesses this science, and all genuine initiation consists in an orderly unfolding of the natural powers of the neophyte, so that he shall become the very thing he desires to possess." End quote. Mystic Masonry, page 34. Joseph Covell. Well, there you have this all-encompassing umbrella look at what we might call mysticism in Masonry. One might liken it to the circle and looking at the point in the circle to the edge of the circle, the radius. And it seems as though every radius in terms of how to connect this to Masonry has in one way, shape, or form been touched on in this piece. So I really appreciate it for what it is. I appreciate the quotes, and I think Brother Joseph has put this together in such a way that it was pretty well executed and allowed, at least in my opinion, most of us to follow along. If you've got views on mystic masonry or the practice thereof, I'd love to hear about them in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group. But next up, let's check out the second part of Brother Stephen L. Harrison's Seeds of Dissent, The Origin of Anti-Masonry, with Part 2, The Incident. Let's check it out. By the time Masonic lodges began to appear in what would become the United States, the Catholic Church was on the verge of banning the craft. Protestant, evangelical churches, strict and unbending in their belief systems, were following suit. In addition, some colonists began to fear the secretive nature of Masonic lodges and their perceived influence over political and economic affairs was threatening the emerging nation. It was not lost on the populace that the Masonic lodges themselves, whether ancient or modern, owed their existence and allegiance to being sanctioned by lodges in England, a country daily waning in popularity with the upstart colonists. This, even though many, if not most, Freemasons went on to support the colonies in the American Revolution. With other priorities to deal with in the fledgling colonies, anti-Masonry was simmering on the back burner, but nowhere near a boil. In fact, membership in the craft was still seen as desirable, an honor, and not something everyone could achieve. A notorious incident began to change things. Daniel Reese was a young apprentice pharmacist working in 1737 at the prominent apothecary in downtown Philadelphia. He was one of those who thought membership in Freemasonry would enhance his career and status in the community. With that, he told his boss, the respected and well-known Dr. Evan Jones, of his desire to join the organization. Dr. Jones also knew about the Freemasons, a group about which he had some doubts. Seeing an opportunity for some mischief, he told Reese he would arrange his admission to the order. Jones and a few of his friends, none of whom were Masons, planned an elaborate mock initiation for the unsuspecting Reese. A few nights later, in the backyard of Jones's home, the group performed the ceremony. John Rummington, a Philadelphia attorney, administered an irreligious and scandalous oath on the naive Reese, after which he was subjected to absurd and ridiculous indignities, given a series of ludicrous signs, and then congratulated on having received the first degree of Freemasonry. On a subsequent night, June 13, 1737, Reese presented himself at Dr. Jones's store to receive a higher degree. The men blindfolded him and escorted him into the cellar. There, the perpetrators forced him to repeat an invocation to Satan, then coerced him into drinking a strong drug, most likely a laxative, quote-unquote, for sport. The group then lit a pan of brandy and camphor and removed Reese's blindfold. At that, one of the sinister bunch confronted him wearing a cowhide cloak and horns, so Reese would assume he was the devil. The stunt failed to frighten Reese, so Jones threw the flaming liquid onto Reese, severely burning him. 3 days later, Reese died. Remarkably, a coroner's inquest acquitted the Masonic imposters, although it severely condemned their actions. However, a grand jury subsequently indicted Jones, Remington, and John Tackerberry, an expelled Mason, for murder. Jones and Remington were found guilty of manslaughter, with Tackerberry being acquitted. The court granted Remington a pardon due to extenuating circumstances, including the need to provide for his family. Jones's sentence, to have his hand branded, was carried out immediately. The Masons came under fire even though they had absolutely nothing to do with the episode. The brothers from St. John's Lodge and Grandmaster published a statement condemning the matter. The proceedings of the trial revealed Benjamin Franklin was aware of the shenanigans. The Court of Common Pleas has appointed him to settle an affair in which Jones was involved. During one of their meetings, Jones told him about the first quote-unquote initiation, and Franklin admitted to laughing heartily, as my manner is. Having heard about Franklin's reaction, Andrew Bradford Franklin's longtime rival in the printing industry, used that information to attack Franklin, as well as the Freemasons in his newspaper, the American Weekly Mercury. Franklin responded in his Pennsylvania Gazette, noting he stopped laughing when Jones told him of the incident with the laxative and the fact the group made Reese swear to Satan. Bradford shot back with a rebuttal that proved to be the opening volley of what has been characterized as the first anti-Masonic series of articles in a newspaper in colonial America. Stephen L. Harrison, 33rd degree, Fellow of the Missouri Lodge of Research. Wow. Have you ever heard that story before? Setting a guy on fire, giving him laxatives, and making him swear to Satan and things? This is just absurd nonsense and wild and crazy behavior. And these guys were caught and tried? Just what a wild story. If you've never heard this before, there's a lot more to check out. I'll put a link in the show notes to the original article in which Brother Stephen Harrison has his citations as well, so you can kind of dig deeper into the story if you'd like. It wasn't always about the Morgan affair, right? We talked about in Brother Steve Harrison's first part of this series, episode number 608 of the podcast called We Shot Ourselves in the Foot, we talked about the Hanoverian lodges versus the Jacobite lodges. And then this incident we just read about doesn't help the situation at all, and then it just gets worse from there. But Brother Steve is doing a serial on this, so we're publishing the parts as they go through, and I look forward to reading the next one for you guys. And of course, I'll put links in the show notes to all of these pieces. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining me on this edifying journey that we all go on each week. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. If you're curious on how you would like to support this podcast, please visit wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various different tiers we have available. And in that, I have to say thank you again to our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the podcast. Without you, this can't happen, so thank you so much. Now, until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
That's it. Okay, girl.